Let's go ahead and get started. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee. It is Tuesday, the 8th of February. Members who are present at this time, Senators Davis, Senators Elton, Senators Huggin, and myself, Senator Terrio. We have two bills up on the schedule today. I'd like to take up Senate Bill 12 first. We have the prime sponsor and staff, Senator Dyson. If you want to bring your staff up, they can come up. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Ambassador John Miller, who is in charge of the federal program on trafficking in persons, is online, and bless his heart, he has stayed till 7:30 his time to be able to testify to the committee. And if you wouldn't object, I would think it would be a courtesy to him to let him speak. And I might say that he tells me that he is unable to speak to the give an opinion about our bill. He can tell us about the history of the federal efforts and their impact and answer questions about trafficking and successful efforts around the world to stop it. But he cannot, because of his professional responsibilities, comment on our specific bill.
Thank you. If there's no objection of the committee members, we will go to Ambassador John Miller. Are you online?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and just to sort of set things up, in each of our packets, everybody should have a packet here that's back about human trafficking. And my staff had highlighted a page, the second and third page. The list, which is the tier placements, is on the third page. It's actually got a page number down at the bottom, 39. And then also the page right in front of that also has some writing here about the three different tiers. So with that, Mr. Ambassador, if you'd go ahead, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before your committee. As I've explained to Senator Dyson, I cannot, on behalf of the State Department, comment on the particular bill. We don't have a position on that, but I can comment, and I'm happy to testify, on the trafficking challenge we face around the world and the impact that federal sanctions contained in federal legislation has had on this challenge. I will try to testify briefly, keep it to 5 minutes, and then open it up to questions. Is that all right, Mr. Chairman?
That's just fine. Go ahead.
The challenge we face is that here in the 20th century, sad to say, slavery exists throughout the world. A lot of Americans tell me, didn't slavery end with the American Civil War? And, of course, government-sanctioned slavery based on color in our country ended with the American Civil War. But slavery in many forms today continues. It's not slavery primarily based on color. What we're talking about here are many categories of slavery, the largest being sex slavery, the second largest around the world probably being domestic servitude slavery, and then factory and farm slavery and child soldier slavery. And our government estimates that up to 800,000 men, women, and children throughout the world are trafficked across international borders every year into slavery. That's 1 year across international borders, and that's not counting internal slavery. So we're talking about a figure overall that's certainly in the millions. Now, what we're trying to do about it, the Congress and the President wants the United States to take the lead on this. President Bush, in his speech at the UN General Assembly about a year and a third ago, the headlines after the speech were understandably on Iraq and Afghanistan, but almost 20% of the speech was devoted to modern-day slavery and what nations in the world can do about it. What we're doing about it is that through this report and through our programs and through diplomacy and persuasion and pressure, we are trying to get governments around the world to make significant efforts. And I think if you'll look at the federal legislation, what you see is that we have a report that we put out. It's published every June. It's prepared in March, April, and May. And it evaluates what governments are doing around the world. By the way, the Justice Department puts out an assessment every year evaluating how the United States is doing. But the State Department report evaluates how governments are doing. And starting last year, there are really four tiers. There's tier one, governments that meet the minimum standards. That doesn't mean they don't have a problem, but they're taking at least minimum efforts in prosecution and protection of victims and prevention and education. And then there's tier two, governments that don't meet the minimum standards but are making significant efforts. Tier two watch list, which is those at the bottom of tier two, which are in danger of falling to tier three. And tier three, governments that are not making significant efforts. The way the law works, the key date is not June, the key date is September. In June, we put out the report, the Secretary of State puts out the report and lists governments in these tiers. And then the law provides that if a government is in tier three, they have 3 months basically to shape up, to undertake efforts on protection, prevention and prosecution. And then in September, the President, on recommendation of the Secretary of State, makes a decision on whether the governments are now making significant efforts and can be raised out of Tier 3, or whether sanctions should be applied in the form of reducing or eliminating certain amounts of U.S., certain categories of U.S. aid. And those categories range from educational and cultural assistance to military aid to support at the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And then the President in September makes that decision. I would have to say, looking back at the last year or two, it's just 2 years ago that the sanctions provision went into place. And I would say the possibility or the threat of sanctions has had a salutary effect. I've noticed that when, for example, in June 2003, there were approximately 15 governments placed on Tier 3, including some allies such as Greece and Turkey, that while there were pro forma denunciations of the report and disagreements, in the 3 months between June and September, most governments that we had civil relations with took many steps, significant steps, arrests, prosecutions, setting up of shelters, working out memorandums of understanding between non-governmental organizations and the police for the handling of victims. Some very impressive steps. And it led to many of these countries being raised. This last year, for example, Bangladesh in June was listed in Tier 3. And by September, they had followed through on a promise that they had made years ago but had not kept, and that is to establish and get operating a special anti-trafficking in persons or anti-slavery police unit. So, to just end my testimony, I would say we have a great challenge. I've described it in number terms. I haven't gone into the stories of individual victims. I go around the world and I meet with individual victims. And if you meet with some of these victims, whether they are victims from such as Katia from a brothel in the Netherlands or Lord from a factory, an embroidery factory in Bangkok, Thailand, you get an understanding of the impact on human dignity and human rights. And of course, there's also an impact on national stability because of the link to organized crime. This has become a major source of revenue for organized crime. So we have a big challenge, but we have a federal law that where the United States is trying to take the lead in meeting the challenge, and we're starting to see results. Almost 3,000 convictions of traffickers last year around the world, way up from previous years. Over 50 countries in the last 2 years have passed anti-trafficking and person laws. So there's some progress. But I think that progress has come not just from diplomacy, not just from putting a spotlight on the issue, that's part of it, but also in part from threat of sanctions in the form of reduced aid by the United States. And with that, let me stop and answer any questions you may have.
We have questions from the committee members.
I've got it.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Ambassador, I noticed that it appears to me that the federal legislation says that we cannot impose humanitarian aid sanctions and also trade sanctions. Can you explain to me what the thinking was on the federal legislation that doesn't allow trade sanctions?
I was not around in 2000, Senator Dyson, or I was not in D.C. or in this position when that legislation was passed. So I don't know the exact thinking. I just have to assume that the Congress thought that humanitarian aid was so important, or trade aid was so important, that they didn't want to put that in the sanctions kit. But that's there are exceptions for humanitarian aid, trade-related assistance, and also assistance to fight trafficking in persons or slavery.
Another question, sir. Does the U.S., I see that we put a lot of pressure on domestic organizations that are involved in sex tourism and so on. Do we put any pressure on American companies that are doing business in countries on Tier 3 and or their complicity with the slave trade in those countries?
Yeah. We have not put pressure as of this time on American companies doing business in Tier 3 in Tier 3 countries. We are starting to work with American business to get them more involved in this issue. For example, last year, the Congress passed legislation that asked for my office and other federal agencies to work with the travel industry and the airlines and the cruise lines to work together to try to warn Americans that are going abroad about the dangers of sex tourism, and making it clear that if they got involved in child sex tourism, they were going to face up to 30 years in prison in the United States. That has been the main involvement between the government and American business on trafficking in persons at this point.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Can you tell me how does the federal law work? We've got proposals here that would put some suggested permissible restrictions on the three branches of government. Is that the way that the federal government law works? What's the mechanism there?
Well, you're going to have to consult your attorneys on that. I don't know. You're out of my range of expertise when you talk about the intersection of of state and federal laws. I'm aware of state governments passing laws that involved sanctions or restrictions on business, state business with certain countries for human rights violations in the past. But I think you're the first state that has considered this possibility, at least to my knowledge, you're the first state that's considered this possibility with relation to modern-day slavery.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
Ambassador Miller, we have considered whether or not to have our effort here extend to the state's investments, and we have an investment fund of our nominally $30 billion, and that investment fund is now guided by what's called the prudent investor rule, which basically tries to have the investments made only purely on their financial economic returns and security, and precludes any consideration of investments based on any other criteria. Does the World Bank or the couple of other world financial institutions discipline themselves to the, quote, prudent investor rule, or are they able to consider human rights and humanitarian criteria in making those investments?
Well, again, you're outside my area of expertise. I think the World Bank considers social factors, but I'm not speaking as an expert here. I have not had any involvement with the World Bank. Just from what I know of it, I doubt that they just consider strictly investment criteria, but you'd have to check that out.
All right. Thank you, sir, and thanks for your efforts on
Well, I thank you for your interest in this area. I know that many states have passed anti-trafficking in persons legislation to put state and local law enforcement to work on this issue along with federal law enforcement. And so I'm not surprised that a state would also consider putting in place a sanction effort to support the federal governments. But as I said, my expertise is just what we're doing here with regards to the challenge of slavery and what the federal government is doing. So as an ambassador or representative of the U.S. government, I can't take a position on your bill.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. Good luck.
Any further questions here? Seeing none, thank you for staying with us so you could testify today.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Now, Senator Dyson, do you want to give your introduction now that we've had that discussion?
Yeah, and I think all of you are somewhat familiar with what we're trying to do here, so I'm not sure that I need to say a lot. We are working on, with some other legislators, the companion pieces that will address putting trafficking in our state law, and also providing respite and services to victims within our own state. This bill is, we have far more of an internal problem within the state than most of us would have ever imagined. And I've provided it in the packet, or Jason has, some of the prominent cases that have come up. As I mentioned the other day, when I first got here 8 years ago, there was a ring supplying little boys here in Southeast to cruise ship passengers for sexual purposes, booked on the internet with their complicity of the parents. There was was commercial activity. One of my foster sons was trafficked to Asian flight crews in Anchorage 20 years ago. I was involved in getting the cops in Anchorage after a liquor establishment in the Spinard area that had several Asian women there against their will and literally held in captivity and brought that. That came down. And I was just told by the state trooper who was testifying at the Children's Caucus today that they've had a couple, three cases they're investigating now where quite young girls, 10, 11, 12, have been imported from third world countries ostensibly to marry men in their 40s and 50s. And it's an open question how much coercion and how much these girls wanted to do this and so on. But it's an ongoing issue with them, and probably more of it going on. And certainly there is a group of people in Alaska who travel to South America and to Southeast Asia to visit the child brothels there. And Representative Croft is working on a bill, and we're working with him on criminalizing the sexual tourism industry here. We're hoping to get somewhere on that. We may combine that with our bill on adding the crime of trafficking to our statutes. So there's two questions here that we should really consider. This bill, as written, is voluntary. The administration and the three departments can choose or not to comply. And we may consider in our wisdom making it mandatory that they comply with imposing sanctions and so on. The other issue is the bill, the A version that you have, does not include the investment of the permanent fund. The F version that you have in your packet does. And the we have been told quite clearly that our permanent fund investments are guided by this, quote, prudent investor rule that precludes them from considering human or social factors in making those investments. So we as a legislature have a choice about that. And so there's are two policy issues that we should consider. And I would encourage us to be thoughtful and deliberative about that. What did I miss?
This is Jason Hooley, staff to Senator Dyson. And the intent of the amendments to the committee substitute was to include some of the quasi-governmental corporations like the Permanent Fund Corporation and so on. After some conversations with the Permanent Fund Corporation, I'm not sure yet if that language actually does that, but that was the intent of the sponsor.
Senator Dyson, the A version language is permissive. It says it may contain provisions. So there's a difference in wording there, but they're both sections or both versions are permissive.
Yes.
And then I see the addition of the permanent fund language here. Why did you change the language in sections 2, 3, and 4 for prohibiting or eliminating financial relationships, and now you were suggesting that it contained provisions for restricting financial relationships? What was the thought between that change in verbiage?
It was intended just to give the agencies responsible a little more discretion, a little more freedom to modify it as they chose. We thought the word restricting was a little more flexible for them.
Have you, has it been suggested to you how the agencies would determine, you know, whether somebody that we're contracting for supplying as post-it notes or whatever has a financial relationship with one of the Tier 3 countries? How would they go about checking on that or evaluating that?
Yeah, I think, thank you. I think that the State Department will be quite helpful in that and would be a good resource for the American firms that are doing that. And there's somebody here from the administration. I believe that the administration, you will hear, is in favor of this kind of action as delineated in the bill. And it, I understood that Governor Murkowski has considered and drafted an executive order that accomplishes exactly what the bill talks about and is quite supportive. And maybe, and I think there's some people here from the administration that may be able to speak to how indeed they would proceed to implement that. Might add one other thing. I've been working on this for a couple of years. All last calendar year, every major international firm executive that I had a chance to talk to, I asked them how their firm would respond to this. And I encouraged them to go to their national or international headquarters and ask them and give us some feedback on how they would be impacted. I did not get 100% feedback, but the ones that I did hear from, they all said, go for it. And they said, all of our international headquarters want to be good citizens, and this will help to give them, I think this phrase he used, stiffen them up a bit at headquarters to make them have a clear policy that will then be easier to implement in the field. And I was glad to hear that. And what I envision is a company that's wanting to come here to bid on our leases or any other activities that are on the table or supply services here, and they are doing business in one of the Tier 3 countries. Our contracting, purchasing people, lease, and so on will say, what is your company's policy in this nation where you're active? And what are you doing there to keep your employees from being involved in exploiting children and to mitigate the slavery that's going on there? That's the kind of thing I expect will happen, and the governor and his people will go through some process to ascertain that it's true and that there is that they are their word is good on their activities.
Section 4 of the bill, which is targeted at the administration, say that the CS is drafted in such a way to try and take in the railroad, ADA, some of the quasi-governmental organizations. Was that a change between the CS and the original bill?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do we have questions from the committee members? Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Senator Dyson. I'm going to make up a hypothetical situation, and maybe you can respond or have somebody from the administration respond. And we'll base it on Section 4 in / F version. I mean, as you pointed out, the development of regulation may or may not happen depending on the administration or the executive. If, in fact, there are regulations that would prohibit financial arrangements with companies doing business in Tier 3 listed countries, and if we had a fact situation that, for example, one of the major producers on the North Slope that is interested in an arrangement for a gas pipeline had interest in a refinery in an oil-producing regime, and I noticed that Venezuela is listed. I mean, how it would seem to me that if this legislation passed, if there were regulations, there are a couple of things that could happen. One is the state wouldn't do business or might not do business with that producer. Another is that the regulations are changed to allow that to happen. And I'm sure there are other situations. But under that made-up fact situation, I mean, I'm interested in whether or not you've had conversations with the administration on how you deal with a situation like that.
I've had only limited opportunities to interact with the, but the man in the governor's office who's had this project, I've talked to at some length. And first of all, nothing in the law precludes us with doing business with a company that's doing business in a tier three country. I suspect all of us can know of examples where honorable companies doing business in dishonorable countries, you know, by whatever, have had a salutary effect on the culture of that country. And, you know, interaction, social, cultural, and economic intercourse have often had a salutary effect. So we are not interested in precluding doing business with a company that's doing business in a Tier 3 country, only that company certify to us in some way that they are not exacerbating the problem there and, in fact, are doing what is within their purview to mitigate it. So there's no prohibition for dealing with those companies that are doing business in those countries. But as you bring up, Senator Elton, push might get to shove. And the day may come when the administration and or we legislators will face the decision. Are we willing to do business with a company or a country that is flagrantly and blatantly trafficking in children and destroying lives? Are we willing to sell our soul to do that? And fortunately for us, our mineral natural resources wealth is such, it's almost never that there's a single bidder, you know, wanting to do business with us. And I think that we will never face the situation where the utilization of our resources or provision of service here, it won't happen if we turn down doing business with pimps.
I can follow up just to make sure that I understand it. I'm going to repeat what I think, what I heard as an answer. So you're not seeing the regulations or the potential regulations that could be adopted by the executive. You're not seeing that as an either-or. You're doing business in a Tier 3 country, therefore there will be financial restrictions. You see the possibility, and because restricting financial relationships seems to be the remedy suggested here. So you're seeing something short of that, that the executive could make a determination that the activities of that company in that country are not exacerbating a trafficking situation, and therefore it would be possible for us to do business with that company.
In fact, probable. But if we choose to direct those who invest Alaska's financial wealth, you know, our various funds, including the permanent fund, and they might face the choice of investing money in the government or the government-owned LNG facilities, you know, somewhere, and that is a Tier 3 country, you know, if we choose to include the investment, which is in the F version, not the A, under this, we might face those decisions. And parenthetically, once we started talking about this, several very wise people said, watch out with this kind of legislation, because it'll come a Christmas tree that everybody will want to hang their private piece of social concern on it, and I will strongly resist that. And if it gets beyond this trafficking in persons, I will withdraw the bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from committee members? I'm trying to look at this. The regulations may contain provisions for restricting financial relationships with persons. So I guess you're taking a little bit of a leap of faith here that those regulations are not going to say, if you're doing business in one of these countries that are on this Tier 3, then you're not going to do business with us, period. And I guess I can see in, you know, it may be a situation where that
that multinational corporation may be the only or maybe the highest and best source of employment in that country that's above board and on the up and up. And we wouldn't necessarily want to cut that off.
That's right. Provide very real-world alternatives for desperately poor people who are selling their children into international slavery or whatever.
Any other questions? We do have folks here from Department of Administration, General Services. We've got somebody here from the Legislative Affairs that can talk about the how this would be implemented in Legislative Affairs. So why don't we start with Vern Jones first. Mr. Jones is the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, I'm Vern Jones, Chief Procurement Officer for the State of Alaska. The administration's worked with the sponsor on this for some time. While we don't think it's probably practical for us to cut all ties with companies who do business in Tier 3 companies, we think that we can implement procedures that would be in compliance with the intent behind this legislation. What we would propose to do is to, in future solicitations and in future contracts, require any businesses that compete for our contracts to disclose whether they have locations in or do business in those Tier 3 countries, and if they do, to require those businesses to submit their policies concerning human trafficking and evaluate those as to whether we think they meet some criteria that's yet to be established. That would be our way of handling it. That way we wouldn't have to necessarily cut ties with countries with businesses that do that operate in, say, Venezuela. And you probably can't think of a major corporation that doesn't do business in Venezuela, from computers to hotels and airlines to Coke and Pepsi. I think that meets with the sponsor's intent here, which is to bring this to light and to highlight the issue and to make sure that we're doing business with companies that have policies and are sensitive to the issue in those countries they're doing business with.
Would that, so you would modify the RFP, basically, form that you send out to all potential bidders for doing business with the State of Alaska, to put them on notice that you want to know what their policies are and that we're watching, we're interested in it. If you found out after entering into a contract with somebody that, in fact, they are a bad player in one of these countries, would that then rise to the level that it would be reason for termination of the contract?
Well, certainly if we put those conditions in place when we did the procurement and have to be a well-thought-out policy and anticipate those sorts of things, then yes. If all we did was ask for a policy and they provided it and later we found out that they weren't complying with their policy and we said nothing about that, that would be a difficult contractual problem we'd have, but I think we would want to put something in place that would put some teeth in it, and as long as we made that clear up front, we would be able to take action.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kind of a follow-up on your question. I mean, if in fact it is the new requirements are noted in an RFP, I mean, what does it increase the likelihood that awarding of the contract could be challenged by other parties that didn't get the contract? I mean, I can see a situation that a disgruntled bidder might say, well, hey, we don't do business in the country they do, and, what were the criteria that you used or the selection committee used as you made your decision?
Through the Chair, Senator Elton, the short answer is yes. Anytime you add requirements that to a procurement that that would have us go and check external conditions, you are increasing the risk of that procurement. You are increasing the availability or the probability that competitors will, if the business is significant enough, try and make a case. I think that's probably a cost of doing business in this case.
I'm not suggesting that's necessarily bad, but it is a possibility. Thanks.
Okay. And is it your view that the language in the backslash F version on Section 4, would that take in the railroad and ADA? Have you looked at it from that perspective, or that's not your area of expertise?
I've not, Mr. Chairman. I have not looked at it from that angle, and I've previous to today not seen Section F, although I would note that we would prefer the language on Section 4 that has us restricting rather than prohibiting and eliminating those relationships.
Perhaps at this point, just because we've got these two versions, if somebody on the committee wants to offer an amendment on which version we should be working off of as a working document, if we were to adopt the F version, it seems like the language for the court, legislature, and administration is preferable. It's got the additional issue of the investment permanent fund.
I move that we adopt the working draft of 24LS01-43/F.
It's been moved that the backslash F version be the working document before the committee. Any objection? Seeing none, that's before us for discussion. Are there any further questions for Mr. Jones? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support Senator Dyson's bill. However, you know, my experience in international geopolitical kinds of things, that unilateral sanctions, economic sanctions, have are so what proposition in all too many cases. In this case, we're talking about a state sanctioning other countries. In your estimation, in the procurement business, whether this is a so what proposition or will it have some real effect? You understand? I mean, we're all compassionate about the cause. The question is whether it's a futile thing we're doing and has no consequences.
To the chair, Senator Huggins, I understand your point, and you're probably correct in that in many cases the business that the state of Alaska has to offer isn't going to cause a major multinational corporation to pull out of a country that they make a profit in. On the other hand, I think that the sponsor's intent here is to highlight the situation to make sure that the businesses that are operating in those countries are sensitive. They realize that those issues are important to Americans and Alaskans specifically, and that they have a sensitivity, they have policies against human trafficking, and I think that probably is a step forward, although, as you mentioned, it probably isn't going to cause people to discontinue in and of itself operations in those countries.
Yeah, no, understand, and I appreciate that, and I'm sorry.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, excellent question, and I think all of us watched the international efforts to eliminate apartheid in South Africa 20 years ago, and that was slow to get going, and all of us kind of wrestled with the philosophical questions. I think that the prize here in Alaska of developing our resources is a huge one, and it will change the conduct of some of the companies who want to do business here. They won't just flick us off and say, phooey, having to comply with being a part of the solution instead of an exploiter is a small cost compared to the privilege of being able to be involved in developing our natural resources. So I think it'll have some cases a salutary effect on those international companies. They will get busy about defining their policy and doing something about implementing it rather than lose the chance to compete for business opportunities in Alaska. Whether it'll change other nations or not, that remains to be seen. But particularly in petroleum, many of the companies that are here wanting and doing business have huge holdings overseas. And if they have to, as a price of doing business here, develop a policy and do something about implementing it, they're going to start having an effect in the tier three countries where they operate. And I believe it'll make a difference, both for the companies and to a lesser extent for the countries in tier three.
Other questions for Mr. Jones?
Well, one other question for Mr. Jones. I look at tier three here, North Korea as an example. My assumption that you're hard-pressed around the world to find many trading partners other than weapons systems with North Korea. Certainly not food. I don't know. Do we do anything with them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Huggins, I'm not sure how many countries we do business with actually operate in North Korea. The ones that caught my attention were the South American countries that do have a lot of recognizable companies there.
Thanks, and Mr. Chair, before we let Mr. Jones go, this provides that the state could be in the position of having a financial relationship with a business or an entity that at the time we entered that business relationship, whether it's a lease or whether it's partnership in the construction of a gas line, wasn't doing business in a Tier 3 country. But because the list is updated, I mean, do we raise legal issues in entering a financial agreement with a company that at some point later on may be doing business in a Tier 3 country that isn't yet listed? I mean, are there legal issues that evolve from that kind of a situation?
Elden, I believe there probably are. And I'm not mistaken. I believe Greece was on Tier 3 not long ago. I think they, if we were to have a country like that suddenly appear on Tier 3, the question is, would we have to go back and get policies from them in order to adhere to our policy? And unfortunately, I think the way we would approach it, I'm can only speak for procurement. We deal with this up front. We deal with it in the procurement stage, and that is a good question. What would you do with a contract you have with one of those companies if all of a sudden a country they do business with appears on the Tier 3 or has changed to Tier 3?
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, and I would anticipate that Mr. Jones and the company may very well put that into the RFP, you know, and say, and if indeed, you know, that the list changes, we reserve the right to come back and ask you about your activities vis-a-vis human slavery in that country.
Mr. Chairman, certainly we will have this proviso in all of our major procurements, and we could reserve the right to do just that. There's maybe a practical question about how do you know what countries are there. It's easy to find out the front end when you require them. It's a little more difficult midway through a contract if it happens that the tiers change.
I'm not sure.
company that responded to an RFP, how they would realistically be able to evaluate whether a country that they do business in, maybe just even a small amount, will or will not in the future take steps that get them on the list or off the list. Senator Dyson.
I think that's exactly why Baxter Miller and company invented the Tier 2 watch list, because those are the ones that are teetering on the edge and are suspect about that very thing. So that gives companies, you know, a chance to see where the action is on those issues.
Any further questions for Mr. Jones? I see none. Thank you. Senator Dyson, I have a question for you on section number 4, since it deals with the administration. We've been sort of focusing on, you know, buying supplies, entering into a lease for office space. But I think this is, I don't know, would this apply to us entering into a lease agreement with one of the major oil companies up on the North Slope, leasing acreage to them? That's a financial arrangement. And I'm just wondering if you've given any thought to the fact that we have this constant tension between the pro-development and anti-development forces in the state of Alaska, and sometimes we're staged for the national argument. Would we have allowed one more hook for the anti-development folks to try and hold up leases that would otherwise go forward by litigation that would come forward and say, now, wait a minute, you can't enter into an agreement to develop that block up on the North Slope because that company has some kind of tie to some developing country that, and what, have you given that much thought, and have you spoken to anybody in the administration about how that could be used as a tool against the state of Alaska?
No, and I think it's a good point. I will recommend to you, Mr. Chairman, that you not take action on this bill today, and we get somebody from the administration to come down and talk to us about that very thing, maybe somebody from DNR. And also, I thought that our original draft covered the investments of our funds. It's only been a week or so ago that I realized it did not, and hence came up with the F version. We have asked the Permanent Fund Board and Executive Director to weigh in on this, and I... Now that you have adopted that version, I think we owe it to them to give them a chance to speak to the Section 4 of the investment and their allegiance to the prudent investor rule, which doesn't allow them to consider any humanitarian social values. And I think we owe it to them. And I sure feel that as a sponsor of the bill.
Any further questions for Senator Dyson? Why don't we go next, then, to Carlos Schofield with the legislature, the State of Affairs Agency.
For the record, I'm Carlos Schofield with the Legislative Affairs Agency, and if this bill became law, our procurement procedures are under the auspices of the Legislative Council, so any procedures that we develop would have to go to the Council. And If it was the will of the council for us to develop procedures like this, where we did have language in our contracts and in our procurement documents that indicated that we would restrict financial relationships, then we would start putting those into those documents. I'd envision this would, people could certify, companies could certify what their relationships were with different companies and what their policies were. And it might be that it would be a council chair decision on whether that company was one that we wanted to do business with.
Okay. And Carla, have you given much thought to how far down the line you'd be trying to reach with your regulations? And I know that, I mean, your agency is the one that operates the legislature, takes care of the room, the chairs, all that type of stuff. And a couple of weeks ago, I noticed that the pencils on the table were from Vietnam. Well, Vietnam's on the Tier 2 list here.
Well, and I know that our pins come from China or Taiwan, and so, but they weren't on the Tier 3. One of the things that I think it's interesting, and maybe is that it also says, or other lists maintained by, I think it's the United States Secretary of State. And the Tier 3 looks like it's fairly easy to get a hold of, but if there were another list, and if we were constantly going out and trying to discover who was on that list, I think that could be a lot of work for us. And it's true, because we provide things, like we buy things for the lounge, we buy things to build this building, and I'm not sure how far down this would go if you buy a part for a computer. How do you know what their relationship is with which company? Those are the thoughts of mine.
Well, I would think that the pencils are probably a couple of steps down the line, and I guess you would be dealing with the office supply wholesaler,
yes.
Basically, not necessarily
yes.
All the way down to the maker of pencils.
So.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you. And then I didn't have anybody signed up, but do we have somebody with the court system here? Guess not. We'll have to check to see whether Chris or Doug are available next time. And Senator Dyson, did you have any wrap-up? Actually, could you maybe speak to the secondary list here? It's pretty clear that this particular list, the 1 through 3 tiers, is up and running, and we all know what it is and where to find it. But what in particular are you referencing to with regards to other lists of countries? Is there a reason why we wouldn't want to go with the sure thing, and then if later on that list falls out of favor or is no longer kept up, the legislature would make a policy call to switch to another known quantity?
I think that the phrase or other list of countries was added in the drafting, not intentionally by our request. It references the U.S. code, and I think that statutory reference talks specifically about this trafficking in persons report, and I think our drafters thought that if the name of this report changes or if the report changes, this code still requires a similar report to be produced, and that's what they intended, I believe.
Okay. Well, I think perhaps we should have some discussion with them. This list, if the State Department should take action to replace it with something else, I think you could have it reworded so that as long as this list is in place, that's the list you go to. If it gets changed, then you switch to something else, but we can work with the drafters on that.
And I will get back in touch with Ambassador Miller and see if what there is any possibility of the list name being changed or something. I think your point's very well taken.
And do you know the current Tier 3 list, is it drafted under this 22 USC?
I believe so.
It's unclear the way this is worded, whether that springs from that federal law.
We'll clarify that.
Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 12 today? At the prime sponsor's request, we'll be holding this bill over. We'll notify committee members and our intent to when we intend to bring it up next. And we will try and have folks from the permanent fund and also the court system here to give us comments on their behalf.
Sure.
Next, we will move to Senate Bill 76. We have Laura Glazer here with the Division of Elections. And Laura, it's not my intent to move the bill today, so let's just get it introduced for the committee members.
Mr. Chairman, Laura Glazer, Director of Division of Elections. What's before you is Senate Bill 76. Went only a short way through the process last year with House Bill 523. The notations in your sectional indicate those sections of what is now Senate Bill 76, which were identical and went through a great deal of discussion over 10 hours in the committee and another time with committee members to get the language where it is now. I don't know how you'd like, whether you'd like me to go section by section. In House State Affairs, we like to say that the title is the sponsor statement, as it's completely inclusive and highlights all of the main portions of law that we're changing.
For today, why don't you give us the 10,000-foot version, you know, overview.
The overview. The changes, I know some people don't like to use the phrase housekeeping. A lot of this is housekeeping. A lot of this is cleaning up the election laws that need change, improvement. We deal with voter residency and a reference to temporary construction camps and go to temporary work sites. We talk about registration. This version here, we've added the option to allow a voter to give power of attorney, special power of attorney. That occurred during this last election. We had spouses and parents of men and women who were serving overseas who asked, if I have power of attorney, may I change a voter registration application or an absentee ballot application for my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife? Under the current law, we couldn't allow that. That's included in this draft, as is the ability to scan a document and include that as an application to the division. We do allow transmission by facsimile. Many of the voters argued, well, if we can send it on a fax and the law says electronic transmission, why can't we scan it? We were advised by Department of Law we could not, so we've added the language here so that it's clear that if a voter wants to transmit that document by scanning the document and making an email attachment to the division, that's something that they can do. I'm trying to think of the highlights, the ones that get people's attention. Early voting sites, Section 9, would need to be designated by the director January 1st of an election year. This last year, a great deal of interest in early voting sites, but what happens when we're asked to set up an early voting site is many early voting sites, like on a base, needed to have all 40 districts, ballots for all 40 districts. Those regional supervisors didn't pre-order that many ballots to be on hand. We chose January 1st as a day so that if the director says in this next election year there'll be early voting sites at these locations, they can be staffed and the ballots can be available for those early voting sites.
Okay, Alton.
Is it your desire, Mr. Chair, that we ask questions at the appropriate time?
Sure, since this is overview rather than wait to the very end, go ahead.
Well, I appreciate your mentioning the sections as you go, because back behind, or before Section 9, is Section 6 that provides notification. And the changes now say that instead of a newspaper published in the House District, it is one that's available in the House District. And at Juneau, that makes sense. I'm not sure how you apply that in some of the House Districts. For example, one where Metlakatla may subscribe to the Ketchikan Daily News, but Cordova to another newspaper.
Senator Elton, through the chair, you probably know in your years of service that most of the division, the regional supervisors, try to anticipate by dealing with their clerks, by knowing the communities, because they do the training with the poll workers, which is the best paper to reach the most amount of people. When it's published in, you look at Metlakatla, there is no paper published in, and yet if the Ketchikan Daily News is always available on Capital City Weekly, there were papers that sometimes we did outreach in before I was director, but it was focused on how to reach the most amount of people. That's the driving goal.
The practice of the division would be that in a House district that stretches from Metlakatla to Cordova, you just because it says publish in a newspaper available doesn't mean that you're just going to pick one newspaper. The practice would be get the word out to both ends of the House district.
Senator Elton, through the chair, if it's a precinct boundary change, it's highly unlikely that there'd be a division of elections employee that would choose to put a notification in a Cordova paper when the precinct is in Metlakatla. So we're going to target, especially in precinct boundary change, that area that where the, most of the voters would be in that precinct. And that, that and there are some locations where the Anchorage Daily News is actually more readily available, where you would not say that was published in their district, but you know that you're going to reach the most amount of voters. So, you know, those are the decisions that are made. Usually regional supervisors are making recommendations. Well, you know, the advertising is centered out of the director's office. It's based regionally on how to best reach the voters.
And I can, having been involved in newspapers myself in the past, I know in Prince William Sound, the Cordova Times and the Valdez Vanguard, what was then the Vanguard, used to be published. Originally it was in Cordova, it moved to Valdez, but it was in the Sound. It's now in Anchorage, published out of Anchorage. So you have those situations.
Sections 7, 16, 17, 18 deal with independent candidates for president and vice president. Example would be Mr. Nader. This year we did not have statutes on the books to deal with independent candidates because this we had worked on these statutory changes. We operated as such. We treated them as though they were party candidates and followed what now, you know, what would be the law should this bill pass. But we had to give them access to the ballot. But we had no statutory provisions prior. Well, we still do not have statutory provisions to deal with independent presidential candidates. So the changes in these sections treat them as though they are a party candidate, meaning that the name of the candidate appears on the ballot and not the name of the elector. It mimics the statute that's for party party candidates. The change in 16, however, after an extensive discussion in House State Affairs last year, they added that an independent candidate for president must also provide the name, Alaska mailing address, and signature of the candidate's state campaign chair, who must be an Alaskan resident. And this requirement exists only for independent candidates. And the reason that discussion came forward was a party candidate, say a John Kerry, George W. Bush, have a party, an Alaska party foundation here. They have bylaws posted with the Division of Elections contact for those people, an independent candidate who may, again, the example, Mr. Nader, come from another part of the country to come to run. How do we do business with them? How do we have contact? And so it was Representative Berkowitz and Representative Grunberg who worked on with the division on language to say, you know, we need a contact, and that so there's more onus on an independent presidential candidate in this in Section 16 than there would be on a party candidate, but their thought was it's to tie to an Alaskan base to show the validity of an Alaska, you know, candidacy. Most of the bill deals with petitions from that set from Section 19 on. A great deal deals with petitions, initiative petitions, referendum, and recall. Did you have a question?
Go ahead.
Before we get to the petition sections, Mr. Chair, Section 15, I can't remember the term of ours, but last year we passed the paper backup, ballot backup. I'm assuming that meshes seamlessly with what you're attempting to do here. That
Senator Elton, through the chair, and I'm sorry that I missed that, as it is a highlight and important. These are standards for voting machines. We had no standards, and when it was House Bill 59, the Harris-Garrett bill that passed, when they were sweeping up their language, they didn't catch this section from our bill and add that to our to theirs. They included some of our early voting requests, but this one got left behind. And basically what it says is that the Division of Elections will only utilize systems certified by the FEC, and all updates to data management systems must be certified before the state implements the system. What happened previous years, there would be an update, and it was to make the system better, but it may not have been certified by the FEC or NASED or a standards board, whether NIST decides to take that on. They weren't certified, and in discussions with the Lieutenant Governor, we want to make sure that any change, you know, if there's a change, even if it's to make it better, it has to be certified before we we put it on our in our voting equipment. So that's why that language is very simple in 15, but that was the intent, and it does mesh with the intent of House Bill 459. Again, I'm not catching all the sections since you asked for a broad overview, so there are other sections that we believe are important as well, but I don't want to say by leaving them out that they're not, but I'm trying to give you the quickest overview. Again, 19 on a petitions, referendum, and recall. We're adding the requirement for a printed name and date of birth to be included when signing an application for a petition. Date of birth is now required on voter registration application, and it becomes yet another identifier to assist the division in qualifying the voter signatures. Right now, all that's required by state law is a signature and address of a voter, and this was what we were hoping is, if you could see a petition booklet, it's very hard to do data entry, and some things we don't get to qualify, because if somebody writes Joe Smith, but their given name is Joseph M. Smith, and we don't have another identifier, and, you know, you pull up Smith, you know, that gets set aside, and we're looking for one more identifier to try and qualify more of the voters who sign a petition.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is a part of several sections, the date of birth requirement. I'm curious about why just the date of birth, because other identifiers, Social Security number or the last four digits of a Social Security number, are also collected by the division. And I'm of an age where I now begin to understand why some people might not want to put down their date of birth. So why restrict it only to date of birth?
Senator Elton, through the chair, it's a good question. This companion bill was up in House State Affairs, and the question came up there as well. The only identifier that's required in voter registration is date of birth. The others are optional. You can choose to give your Social Security number, your last four, your driver's license, or a voter ID number. So say, for instance, a voter chose when they applied to give us the last four digits of the Social Security number. When they signed a petition, they gave us the ADL, the driver's license number. It's no longer a check to a check, whereas date of birth is a constant identifier, and it is required on a voter registration application. So that was why division employees came up with the idea to, you know, because they get as frustrated as anyone trying to qualify these signatures, and you know, it gets lost in the mire. What's the way that we can help? That was a directive by the court, certainly after the Hindenburger case, which dealt with the marijuana petition, was, you know, the division standards, and there are changes to the law here. There were accountability reports that were required, and Judge Sedek told us, you know, that bar was too high. It didn't help the people. So we tried to think of the ways that, you know, that we could change the law to make petition drive successful, but prevent fraud. So that was the areas we were targeting. Also,
it seems to me that as far as somebody signing a petition booklet too, they might not have their driver's license. I don't know my number. I do know my Social Security number, but not everybody would. But everybody knows the birthday. So you know,
then
for a good match. And the instant availability of that information seems like that's the one identifier that fits those two categories.
And that's why the discussion came up earlier, well, would that disqualify somebody? This was our best attempt, you know, that all of you think it through and we're willing to work. But ours was to help, to qualify more rather than for it not to do so. We also, with Lieutenant Governor, like to talk about adding a date that you sign the petition, as you're probably all aware, on the CTAX petition, and the questions about the validity of the signatures on the CTAX petition, and the question came up, when someone signs a petition, are they a registered voter? And in law, right now it's not clear that you're required to be a registered voter. Certainly we make the assumption that they're a registered voter, but a petition booklet is out, by statute allowed to be out for a year. So when somebody has signed it, they may not be a registered voter, but by the time we qualify them, they are a registered voter. Do the policymakers see a problem with that? Do you say that they should be a voter on that date? And if you put a date that you signed it, we do know what day you became an official voter. That's logged in to our database. So that's not included in the law. If somebody sees fit to make an amendment to make that change, it might be something that people want to consider.
Go ahead, please.
I just want to make sure I understand what I just heard as far as. So there is a possibility that that there could be a requirement that date of birth is important, and if you're going to be old enough to vote at the time the initiative is on the ballot, that could be something that this committee or another committee of the legislature could decide to use as a cutoff point, or that whether they were a registered voter on the time they signed the petition book. There's a couple of different avenues that you're suggesting could be applied if, in fact, there were an amendment that encompassed what you're suggesting.
Senator Elton, through the chair, the date of birth would be used as an identifier. I wasn't thinking that deep into whether they would be a qualified voter at the time that the petition, should it go on the ballot, because the law says when you sign the petition, you shall be a qualified voter, so that the age would not be a question then. But then the date that they signed it, were they a qualified voter when they signed the petition? It says they shall be qualified voters. There is no mechanism for it, nor has there been in the history of the division, a way to test that. I mean, we believe that if you're qualified at the time that we do the data entry, you're a qualified voter. But were you a qualified voter on this date? We have no way of knowing, because we do not know what day that booklet was out or the day that voter signed it. So do you want to add that as another column on a petition book that somebody has to date the day that they signed it?
It would seem to me that you can register to vote and not be an official registered voter until after your birthday. How does that work? I mean, we sign people up. I certainly encourage graduating seniors to sign up if they're going to be of age before the election. So they fill out their paperwork, they send it in to you. When are they officially a registered voter? On their birthday?
They are a qualified voter on the day that they have registered. They cannot access a ballot. So that, you know, it says, you've registered to vote and you're a qualified voter 90 days prior, I think it's 90 days prior, to the to the election. So you're considered a qualified voter. I would guess the test would be, should there be a special election, something that required an election prior to 90 days, I would guess that would be when the question would come. But otherwise, I think that's gone.
So a person who is going to turn 18 the day before the November election, they can be considered a qualified voter.
Birthday.
When?
In the statutory language, they're a qualified voter when we've completed the data entry. Would their ballot count? Their ballot would count if they were, their birthday was 90 days prior. I got to make sure it's 90 days because I keep going to 90 days.
Yeah, so when, we encourage graduating seniors to do that, but could a 16-year-old go and fill out the paperwork and say, I'm going to be a qualified voter 2 years from now? Sign me up?
Mr. Chairman, no, they receive a letter back from the division that says you will not be able to vote in the 2000.
Well, you won't be able to vote, but would they be able to fill out the paperwork and send it in to you?
Well, we wouldn't make the entry. Yeah, it's a question of semantics. Yes, they could send it in. No, they would not become a qualified voter. 90 days prior.
So you'll only log them into the system 90 days prior. Okay.
And if they've signed it 3 days short, they get a letter from the division. You need to reapply on this. You missed your 90 days, your math bet.
So how does that match up with the initiative process then? If somebody's, you said these initiative booklets are out there for a year, can a 17-year-old sign the initiative booklet?
Thank
accuser.
I really want to fake an answer, but I think the answer is I'm not really sure.
Okay, something to look into.
But right now, if that person signed and they were a voter on our database, they would that signature would qualify. So if they're in the database as a qualified voter, then the answer is yes. That their signature would be qualified.
But they couldn't be in the database unless
90 days prior.
90 days, maximum 90 days prior. Okay. What are the highlights that you need to point out before?
So date of birth. In the areas of all in initiatives, referendum, and recall. Defines the qualifications of petition circulators, that a circulator be a citizen 18 years of age or older and an Alaskan resident. When changes were made previously to Alaska law, that was left out. Circulator, Supreme Court says you can't require them to be a qualified voter, an Alaska voter, but we can require that they are 18 years of age or older, an Alaskan resident, and a citizen of the United States, and they sign an affidavit, which is kept with the Division of Elections. You don't have to be a voter to circulate, but you do have to meet that test. And now those changes to the law have been included in three separate sections. A lot of this has been, we found in initiatives where requirements were made for both the signers, the circulators, the sponsors. And what we did was in the following sections, make them all gel so that the rules are basically the same for initiative signers, referendum signers, and recall signers. In the recall section, we got to read that very carefully in the last year, where it probably had not received attention till then. We found that Section 34 adds a requirement for the printed name and date of birth, again for recall, removes a requirement for an additional 100 signatures of qualified voters. The current statute was unclear as to whether the 100 who signed were required to have voted in the preceding general election of the official sought to be recalled. So that language has been removed in what's before you. Additionally, the three sponsors designated, the committee representing the sponsors, must provide their name, mailing address, and signature. And that's just continuity in the sections. Again, 37, in recall, it had said there was language referring to a duplicate copy. There are no duplicate copies assigned in a recall petition effort, so we removed it. Again, qualifications of circulator, same. Changes in all three sections for display of the change to the law in an initiative or a referendum or a recall. Current law says there shall be 10 copies of each of the proposed changes of law and 5 posted in a precinct in a polling place. Many places posting 5 was difficult at best, so we reduced the number available because they're recycled in a polling place and the posting requirements. Those were changed in all three, initiative, referendum, and recall. Section 43 defines in law voters that are unaffiliated with political parties. And this has been a standard procedure in the division, but when I became director, I realized we had no statutory reason to group voters. So it says clearly a nonpartisan and without preference for a political party if the voters registered as nonpartisan on a voter registration form. They are undeclared if the voter registers as undeclared or fails to declare an affiliation with a political group or political party or declares an affiliation with an entity other than a political party or political group. And then other, if the voter declares on the voter registration form an affiliation with a political group. So those are laid out in statute here in Section 43. It's been a procedure in the division. It was a policy, but there have been nothing. You know, when they got a voter registration form in a region and they saw no mark, they put that voter as undeclared. Now a voter is notified that when they get the card. So they still have the opportunity to change it. But we had no statutory provisions to set out those groups of voters, and so that's there before you for your consideration. 44 is recognized political party status. As you might know, the statute lays out the 3% bar for being a political party. That was dealt with in House Bill 414 last year. The division wanted to set bright lines so that you couldn't lose your party status. Party status based on a 3% margin of a preceding general election number varies month to month. As you can guess, a party can go up and go down and up and go down. I believe it was the Libertarian Party last year that fluctuated, almost by month. They were a party, they weren't a party, they were a party. But when we start to set the ballot, we want it in law that, you know, from, and so it's by on or before May 31st, and that we can't remove their political party status. If they do dip after June 1st until after the general election, we can't remove their party status. We've set the ballot. We've started the printing of the official election pamphlet. Voters expect that their candidates are valid. And so this statute lays out, this section of statute lays out the procedure for verifying and a political party and whether they become a political group and how they reaffirm their status as a political party. Definition of re-registration just needed to be cleared up. Section 46 through 48 are recommendations to Title 29. 46 through 48, Title 29, and that's been a request from DCED, who works with local elections. And says that a qualified voter is a voter who's registered to vote within a proposed municipality at least 30 days prior, rather than has been a resident. I'm trying to recall the discussion, but I believe what the concern was is the proof that you were a resident for 30 days, but we can track when they were registered in that particular municipality or borough. And again, changed to 47 and 48. 48 pulls qualified voter back to AS 1560-010. Which is our definition section. And that's pretty much the broad-based overview of the bill.
Okay. Questions from committee members? See, I also had Linda Murphy listed with the Kenai Borough. Ms. Murphy, are you online?
Yes. Senator Terrio, can you hear me?
Yes. Did you have specific sections of the bill that you wanted to highlight for us?
I was mostly concerned about the sections dealing with registering to vote and requesting an absentee ballot by power of attorney. I'm concerned that this will open the door for voter fraud. We make it very easy for one to register to vote or to apply for an absentee ballot in the state. One can do it in person, by mail, by fax, and under this bill, by scanning a document and then emailing it to the Division of Elections. And I just want the committee to consider this section carefully before you act on it.
Thank you. There is separate legislation that I have in the system, Senate Bill 36, that deals with that section. It does not include the scanning and language. And I guess when I was just looking over that a few minutes ago, reading through the bill, I thought, well, we are trying to make it clear that no individual or party can interject themselves between the absentee ballot requester and the Division of Elections for processing that sensitive personal information. And I wouldn't want to open up a big loophole by allowing, you know, it to be done under, you know, an affidavit. So that section may come out of the bill altogether.
Thank you.
Was there any other section? You said the absentee voter request.
And also there's a similar section under the allowing one to register to vote by power of attorney. You know, voting is a really precious right that we have, and with any right comes a certain measure of responsibility. And I really don't see why this is something that we need in state law.
Yeah. And Laura, could you respond to that, because you had a specific instance that you're trying to deal with on that.
Senator Terrio, I made a commitment to some family members who again had spouses and children overseas in a situation they weren't expecting to have to make a change to a residence address or a mailing address on an absentee form, and a parent or a spouse is here in the state trying to make a change for them, has full power of attorney, but a spouse or a child has been stationed somewhere where there is no voting officer and no way to assist them in making a change. And the spouse, you know, was pleading for, you know, a way to do that, and we don't have that under current law. Certainly, we have the same concerns about voter fraud, and we take that to the legislature for your consideration. I know House State Affairs Representative Grunberg was asking whether it would be better to have the broad-based power of attorney. I'm not knowledgeable about power of attorney laws, but I believe the recommendation here was that this be a specialized power of attorney so that when somebody gives it to a parent or spouse or to anyone else, that it's specific to voter registration or changing an absentee ballot application, so that that voter who is being represented by another person understands the power that they've just given to someone else, that it's not in the broad-based power of attorney. I'm giving you a power of attorney, you know, to take care of banking and everything else, and then the spouse or the parent changes your voter registration application.
I'm just trying to think, if the person has the wherewithal and the time to take care of that, sign all that the paperwork before they leave, couldn't they also just go ahead and apply for the, or take care of whatever needs to be done with your department? Or if they're receiving this power of attorney via fax or mail or whatever from overseas or wherever, why wouldn't they be able to take care of the business that they've got to do with the Division of Elections?
Senator Terrio, we're okay with whatever the decision. It was a heartfelt promise that I felt like we needed to bring it forward for the discussion, and certainly we don't want to do anything that would interfere with the integrity of the process or cause for voter fraud. It was truly with good intentions that we brought this before you.
Senator?
Yes, go ahead.
Could I respond to that? I guess I wouldn't have really a problem with someone who was correcting a mailing address for a loved one who was overseas representing our country in Iraq or wherever. But I'm referring to the initial voter registration. And as you said, if you have time to fill out all the paperwork for a power of attorney for voting purposes before you leave the country, you certainly should have time to go online, download the voter registration application, and get it into the Division of Elections.
Senator Huggins?
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I have this right, Mr. Chair, that power of attorney is for people out of the country. Is it exclusive to that, or how broad?
Senator Huggins, to the chair, no. It was for parents and spouses that raised the question this last election cycle. The way the law, the section is before you, it would allow anyone who had special power of attorney to make a change to voter registration or an absentee ballot application to act in on that person's behalf. So, if your question is, could that person be in the state in the same city, but have the specialized power of attorney to take care of that question? The answer is yes, as it is before you.
That's interesting. I don't know. I guess, you know, just the reason we're dealing with this proposition is because fraud, waste, and abuse. And now, this opens Pandora's box. You write on a piece of paper, anybody go, you know, I understand the overseas part of it in absence, but, you know, we're having a wide open.
Yeah, I think the policy balance that we have to strike is trying to accommodate the few, but whether, in fact, it does open up Pandora's box for the many.
Right.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I would encourage members to read through it or
you know, have staff look through it to try and find any areas in what is a fairly lengthy bill that you have questions on, so we can try and deal with them in a CS before we hear the bill again. With that, we will adjourn for the day.